Ladies and gentlemen, before I forget, tonight we'll have dinner where we were going to have dinner last night at the Tiki Hut, which is you go out by the pool and take a right. No? Okay, disregard my previous announcement. We'll not be in the Tiki Hut tonight. Okay, well, you don't get to see the great Tiki Hut. Visit this afternoon if you get a chance. I want to take a couple of minutes before we start. You all know that we transcribe all these conversations. We put your interventions in. We put your pictures in. We've also been audio taping them and then videotaping them. And we've now got a brand new website. So it's up here on your screen. It just started. It's been being unveiled this week. The Faith Angleform website, and on this website you can go, and we've been doing this for 17 years. You can get copies of any of the transcripts, whether the subject is Mormonism and politics, or radical Islam, or evangelicals and politics, or, for instance, we had Dr. Albert Robitaille from Princeton on forgiveness in the African American church experience right after what happened in Charleston. So we try to make the topics as topical to the subjects that you all are covering now, and then we get them up on our website as quick as we can. And if you just click on one of those transcripts, you'll see what a transcript looks like. Well, maybe there you go. And we also have short little, YouTube-type excerpts from each of them also. So, well, I don't need to tell you more about that other than to say that if you go to faithangle.org, you're going to be able to find every transcript from every one of our meetings with some of your interventions, even your photographs in there. So everything is on the record here, unless you say I'm about to say something that's off the record. So we tried to make it user-friendly, and you can go back to past conferences and have a look. So anyway, we want to draw your attention to the New Faith website because you're in it. Thank you. Well, as I said, the bios of our speakers are in your packets. Ken Woodward was a reporter for Newsweek magazine, a religion reporter for almost 40 years. He has a brand new book out called Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. With the kindness of the publisher, each one of you get a free copy of this book. But we decided not to give it to you during this session because we don't want you reading it while Ken is speaking. We'd rather you look at the book after you're stimulated by what he has to say. Ken Woodward has done many, many, many cover stories for Newsweek. I'll call your attention to one. Back in 1976, I still have this, as my wife says, every magazine that ever exists in my basement. This was written by Ken Woodward called Born Again, the Evangelicals, which was a lot about the rise of Jimmy Carter, of Charles Colson. some of you don't know that my first job out of college, I was the research assistant to the infamous Watergate felon, Charles Colson. And Colson, as you all know, had a Christian conversion experience while in prison and came out and founded a group called Prison Fellowship, which is the prison ministry to prisoners. And he got so interested in the subject of revivals and awakenings in America and the fact that America needed one that he brought down a historian from the Boston area every Monday to speak to about 12 of us about the history of awakenings in American culture and society. And Chuck Colson was riveted by these lectures and was so hoping it was happening in America. One day he came bounding him, and I was a little skeptical about the fact that an awakening was not occurring in America. And one day he came bounding my office and he said, "Mike, look, cover of Newsweek. I told you, revival's breaking out in the land." I said, "Chuck, the cover of Newsweek does not a revival make. Just because Newsweek has discovered American evangelicals does not mean that they're taking over the country. Oh, you're too cynical. I told that story to Ken, and he'd never heard it before, but it's a true story. Chuck thought that a cover story Newsweek meant revival was breaking out in the land, when actually it was just a story about what does Jimmy Carter believe as a Southern Baptist and all those people around him. Ken Woodward has covered everybody, from Billy Graham to Jerry Falwell to various popes to the Dalai Lama to liberal Protestants, conservative Catholics. There's not hardly anybody. And one of the great benefits of his book is Ken emphasizes that the way to do a story is you had to be there. And he always would get on the road and go meet with people personally. And that's what makes the book so entertaining and insightful. So we're delighted. I asked Ken, come and tell us the things you learn, lessons you learn, and observations from your 40 years experience. And then we're going to hear from Grant Wacker. Ken, you're on.
All right. Apropos of talking about instrumentalizing your jobs, I was at Newsweek 38 years, so you can realize why I don't understand how they have to move every 5 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about Newsweek because it doesn't exist anymore, at least the way I understand it. And I want to make all you younger journalists jealous. I walked in off the street and got that job as a religion editor right off the bat. And I got hired because, not in spite of the fact that I'm Catholic. It was toward the end of Vatican Council II. Time magazine was bidding us. They had way more people in the Rome Bureau to cover the Vatican and winding down the Pariti and things like that. And my opposite number, oddly enough, was a guy that graduated, as I did, from Notre Dame only 5 years earlier. And he was shaped by a man named Frank O'Malley, and we're on the subject of religion and culture. And I wanted to do what he did. And he had interviewed, he'd put, because Luce was very interested in religion, and because religion was in the air at Time magazine, they did Reinhold Niebuhr on the cover, and Paul Tillich on the cover, and John Courtney Murray, who played golf with Luce, on the cover. And I thought I'd be doing the same, doing profiles of famous thinkers and theologians. Never did. That was the age of the Giants. By the time I got the job, the age of the Giants was over. I ended up doing more sociology than I ever, and I hated sociology in college. A couple of examples, though, a little firsts. Shortly after the council, I did a cover story called How U.S. Catholics View Their Church. And Newsweek, then, we hired the pollster for Kennedy. I've forgotten his name. It's famous. Lou Holtz. Yeah, Lou Holtz. I would say Lou Holtz because I went to Notre Dame, but you're right. And nobody had ever done it. Nobody, no institution, least of all the Catholic Church, had ever asked Catholics how they view their church. So that was a first. And then after the Six-Day War, we put the American Jews' New Pride, New Problems on the cover. The American Jews' New Pride and New Problems. American Jews had never been on the cover of any magazine before then. American Jews have never been on the cover of any magazine since, at least to my knowledge. There was a lot of nervousness. The editorial department was top heavy with Jewish editors and writers. The managing editor came in and said to me, you know, Ken, as I used to say in the shtetl, can this be good for the Jews? And I said, you know, you don't ask me about the Catholics. You don't ask me about the Protestants. What's going on here? Well, there was nervousness. Ed Kosner, some of you might remember him, was editing the Nation section. And the cover image was a Star of David in red, white, and blue, which he had cut out the star, made his Jewish colleagues in the Nation department cut out the stars and hang it around their necks. Now, that was kind of grim humor, but it tells you a bit of the nervousness about doing that cover. I also did the ideas section for 10 years, which is really important because it got me into everything. It got me into more psychology than I ever wanted to read and more sociology and the rest. But it was a great relief from writing about religion, and that way I could see, particularly in things like transpersonal psychology, you know, that's going out of body and things like that. We're really trying to, the social sciences, which they've always been since the beginning of sociology, certainly, try to answer the same questions that religion does, but, in a very different way. I also got to travel. I wrote cover stories from Africa and England, and I got to the Soviet Union, and that was another thing we did. If we in the back of the book, if you were the specialist, you got to be sent places, even though we had bureaus there. Just one quick story, because I'm not going to be talking. I'm going to be talking about American religion here. They sent me to the Soviet Union, and one of the stories I wanted to do was how do you, you know, talk to people who teach atheism? It was a required course in high school and in college. And I didn't know I was going to meet the Komsomol, and they, you know, big table like this. I'm on the other end, right? And, you know, the women with the short cropped hair, they were wearing the uniforms right out of these Cold War movies. They really dressed that way. And so you're a believer, I believe. I said, well, yes, I think we're all believers here. We just believe in different things. I followed a teacher of atheism around, and finally we were going to get through. And you could see the kids weren't interested. I was sitting in his classes. Either they never met a believer and they didn't give a damn. Why do I need to know this sort of thing? It was like an apologetics course. And if I'm a secret believer, I don't want to have to be taking this course. But and then he cried in his vodka that night and said, you know, I get no respect. The Academy of Social Sciences doesn't respect me, and the kids don't respect me. And I thought, oh, my God, that sounds like every Sunday school teacher I'd ever heard of. Probably a worse job. Then when I left Newsweek, interesting enough, there still wasn't anybody that knew anything about religion except one guy, the editor-in-chief, John Meacham, which is why Meacham wrote all the cover stories on religion after I left. Being an expert there meant you were an expert. So people would go to the medicine editor and tell them about their aches and pains, go to the law editor and try to find out something about a legal problem they had, and they'd come to me and say, you know, I'm a thus and such. Do we believe in this? I had Oz Elliott, the great editor, there come in and close the door, sit down 2 years after I was elected. I mean, he hired me, looked me in the eye, thought I was going to be fired. And he said, you know, I'm an Episcopalian, and I just got divorced. I didn't know either of those things. And you know, they won't let you marry in my church for a year. Can you find me a minister to marry me? So you had all kinds of extracurricular chores that were expected of you. I got 90 publications coming into me, 90, from Playboy to the Hawkeye Methodist, I remember. I used to read the state papers for the Baptists and then so forth to see how they talked among themselves. Because I was on a learning curve. Just because I was Catholic didn't mean I knew that much about Catholicism. And because I Notre Dame, they figured I did. But I had to learn about everybody else as well. By the way, we also got free books. We could buy any book we wanted. And in those days, Doubleday would take back any book. So if I got a book I didn't want, I'd take it back and get one I did. Within 2 years, I had a library, which I sustained at 4,000 volumes. I have to tell you, greed never felt so virtuous. When Time and I knew things were coming to an end when Time and Newsweek started cutting back on their bureau systems around the world. My experience there, yes, I did go places, but it was wonderful to be able to press a button and have the bureaus from around the world send you files. We got much more information coming into us than could ever go out in the magazine. And I think of one time I did a cover story on death and dying, and we had a wonderful quote from Martin Heidegger from the Bonn Bureau, and it was actually understandable. The trouble was it was too long, so Martin Heidegger never made the cut getting into Newsweek magazine. We were allowed to write for other magazines, which was not verboten at Time magazine. My nom de plume was what I drank. It was James Michael Beam. So if you run across James Michael Beam's name, I'm the one that wrote it. And today we have 700 alumni who still stay in contact with each other. It's a very homey, chummy group. Two reunions in Manhattan. Okay, now Michael's asked me to suggest or tell what I've learned. Since I was on a steep learning curve, I learned a lot in the beginning. I had never met a bishop who had a wife. Didn't think that was possible in my world. I'd never run across a church, I mean a denomination, in this case the Presbyterians, who would rewrite their creed, updated from time to time. I thought creeds were forever. I learned that most Protestants could not recall which doctrines distinguished Presbyterians from Lutherans or Methodists or Congregationalists. It seemed to me that the Presbyterians did the thinking for the Methodists, and the Methodists did the feeling for the Presbyterians, and the Episcopalians did the drinking for both of them. These were the real distinctions, I found out. I also found out, and this is really rather more serious, which is when Protestants talked about church, whether it's evangelical or a mainline, and Catholics talked about church, they really were talking about two different things. Correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, but the Protestant will talk about church as the church, the congregation that he or she belongs to. And there's the wider sort of vaporous body of Christ. Catholics always talked about the institution. It was the church, and it could be the focus on their parish, but they always knew the bishop. Or if they're complaining about the church, it might be the bishop, or it might be the Pope in Rome, for that matter. Albert Outler, a great Methodist historian that I met after Vatican Council II, says, Ken, you got to learn something here, man. He was from Texas. And he says, deep down, he says, Protestants distrust the structures they've created, meaning the denominations, because they were created in this country, after all. And he says, after the council, he says, deep down, Catholics, even liberal Catholics, for them, Holy Mother of the Church is, damn it all, Holy Mother of the Church. And in that sentence, you can learn a lot. There's a kind of solidity in theirness. Like it or not, it's sort of there. I learned Judaism from Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who became a mentor to me, close friend. I profile him lovingly in the book. I did a story on him because when he moved over to teach at Union Theological Seminary for a semester, and he invited me back, and I would sneak out and go up, and he had this little tiny office, no bigger than the bathroom in Jewish Theological Seminary, because he was maltreated by these people who ran the seminary, who were, your basic sort of Enlightenment Jewish scholar. And Heschel was a blue-blood Hasid. And I would walk in there, and the books are stacked like stalagmites, on a table and on a bum behind him, and he was a very small man. You felt these things were going to fall on him, and he'd be buried with his beloved books. But he always started out by saying, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you a story. Well, that's what I'm doing today, is telling you a story. What I learned from him, he came back from Rome one time, and he was so excited, called me up, breathless, could hardly get the words out. He says, it's terrible. You got to write about it. It's awful. What are you talking about, Rabbi? Well, it's terrible. They're selling their statues in Rome. And I pictured, La Dolce Vita. Remember the opening scene where the statue's being carried by a helicopter? Well, maybe you haven't seen it. But in any case, he comes from a there shall be no graven images tradition, but he understood, or what felt he did, what that selling of statues meant for a tradition that was very different from his. So I learned that people who are deeply formed by one religious tradition are much better, much in a better position, better able to understand people from a tradition not their own. They understand what immersion in a tradition can mean. Imagine when Heschel met Merton. Well, I know what happened, because they talked for pleasantries for about exactly 4 seconds, and then they just got right down to it in the back of a taxi on the way back to Gethsemane. The other related principle, I think, is you never really know your own religion well, assuming you have one, until you immerse yourself in at least one other with sympathetic understanding. And I think that's something Billy Graham never understood, and that most evangelicals do. If you're out to convert people, you're not listening to them. But I think it's difficult for most Catholics, too, for a different reason. They're still preoccupied studying themselves. So most of what I learned, I have in this book. And the reason I wrote it is the same reason that most journalists and historians write books. It's because I had a lot of stories that told me they needed telling. So it is full of anecdotes. But it is a history. I view it as a social history that takes religion and moves it from the periphery to the center of the narrative, which is not what most social historians do. I think, for example, you've probably read it, David Halberstam's book on the 50s. Here is the most religious period in the history of America was the 1950s, which, by the way, I take to mean a 20-year period from 1945 to 1965 when the troops go in a big-time way under LBJ. And yet he never mentioned religion even once. The stories are arranged along a double helix plot line. One line traces out the decline of institutional religion from that post-war era to the end of the century and beyond. I talk about at that time, not only was religion strong, but it had, if you will, civic and political and cultural support. To be religious was to be patriotic. We were in a war of liberation, long before they had liberation theology talk. And we were to liberate the captive nations of Central Europe from the yoke of communism. My university's motto, "For God, Country, and Notre Dame," expressed it very well indeed. It's now, I think, for Notre Dame, God and country. I think they've the way they raise money, it's always Notre Dame first. But by the end of the decade, we have what we've been talking about, which is the nones. I would suggest from what I've read of polls and so forth that maybe 24-25% of Americans put religion somewhere near the center of their lives, somewhere near the center. And a lot of the rest is, you know, watching Osteen on television and things like this. The other plot line, second half of the 20th century, witnessed an outburst of religious enthusiasm and volatility not seen since the Great Awakening in the middle of the 19th century, which brought us the Mormons, the Disciples of Christ, and all these good things that Grant Wecker teaches. So that wasn't expected. Hence, my title of the book is Getting Religion, which is a line from Mencken, and it refers to the various ways and forms in which Americans got or acquired religion, including important alternatives to religion, like Werner Erhard's Est, Oprah's Vaporous Spirituality, the transpersonal psychology. I mentioned going out of body. We had a guy in the 80s, a Virginia businessman named Monroe, and he told me, sent 1,400 psychologists out of body. And most of them came back. One of them was Kubler-Ross, and I had an interview with her on death and dying, and she told me. She zipped and zapped and went to other spaces and found other beings, and it was so nice to know that there were other beings out there, and also that there were other, you know, people on the other side after death. I think, as you all know, she went off the deep end, but she said to me, you know, it's so nice in this work, and it was hard work, sitting at the edge of the bed with the dying, and I think it got to her. But in any case, she told me this story, which was that she said, you know, and one of them came back and thanked me. And I said, really? Yeah, last lady. And she left a note for the Unitarian minister who also helped out. And I said, Elizabeth, you remember Elizabeth? She looked like the old Dutch cleanser girl, you know, on the short cropped hair and busy and serious and so on. She said, yeah, I can get it for you. So I got it from the Unitarian minister. and I printed it in as instead of a picture, I printed it in the cover story, this letter from someone beyond the grave, thanking her and so forth. And we had 400 or 500 letters to the editor for that issue. Not one of them questioned the authenticity of that letter. So that tells you a little bit about the times in which I was writing. There were more. That's when universities like Columbia and so forth had departments of thanatology. When high schools would try to get high school kids used to, the idea of death by going down to the mortuary and have them lay in coffins. The whole preoccupation with death was one of the dimensions of that time that I talk about. So I try to explain why these things happened, and mainly through stories and about the major figures and the events and the political, culture, and religious backdrop to that. Now, if you look when you get the book, the table of contents, the word Protestant, Catholic, or Jew does not appear in any of the chapter titles. What you're going to come across are categories that I created, like embedded religion, movement religion, entrepreneurial religion, and I did this as ways to think about how religion in that era was connected to social change, social migrations, movements, culture, politics. And together they represent how I have come to think about American religion as I experienced it both personally and professionally. For example, there's a chapter called Sacred Families. J. Gordon Melton, who studied those things, argued in a book, listed them all, 370 new religious movements or groups or cults in the 80s. Some of them were resurrected from previous times and so forth. I think he overstated it. Well, that's a way of a lot of kids got religion. Some kinds pretty dangerous religion. If you were a parent and your kid was you couldn't see him because he or she was in a cult, you were sorely wrought. But what I did was connect this up with the breakdown of the family and of traditional marriage and family structures, beginning in the 60s with the Moynihan Report and the Black family structures, for which, Black leaders gave him a holy hell, except for Kenneth Clark, as I remember. And the feminists were after him because, after all, weren't these fatherless children, weren't their mothers, battling patriarchy? Well, no, they weren't, as a matter of fact. So how do we connect the one with the other? Well, by the 20 years later, the indices of what Moynihan called social pathology here were now true of white American families. And of course, the Black family got even worse. And so he wrote a wonderful essay called Defining Deviancy Down. Because once the whites were doing it, then it was okay. And it became acceptable. And I think we've been talking about that. So changes in the family structure, changes in the cultural attitudes toward this had a lot to do with the rise of the cults because a million kids a year were running away from home. Now, these were not Huck Finns going down the Mississippi. These were not poor kids, by and large. These were kids from junior, senior high school, freshman, sophomore college, especially. They were from middle class and better homes. And very often the cults that they join, I think the Unification Church is a good example. They had Dr. and Mrs. Moon. They were the first parents. There was Bo and Peep. There were any number of these people. And they were going into reconstructed families. So that's one of the ways that I try to connect up what's going on in the society as a whole with the emergence of different forms of getting religion. That was also the time, Bill Galston will remember, where Jimmy Carter finally did it, a White House conference on the family, then there was a White House conference on the children. There was tremendous preoccupation with this. You don't hear about that today. So the religion, if you think of this book as a palimpsest, did I pronounce that right? You know, one of those things where you put one leaf over on the other. The first one is still there, but now you're seeing it through something else. The basic form of the religion, the way most people get religion, is what I call embedded religion. By that I mean religion acquired through communal formation. It's the kind of religion that one is born into, religion that is handed down and therefore tied to ethnicity and extended families and sustained by local institutions, neighborhoods, as well as obviously churches and synagogues, and now mosques. Religion so embedded goes with the territory. It's embedded in the landscape. Think of Wisconsin. You're probably, if you live in Wisconsin, your background, maybe even your foreground, is either going to be Lutheran or Catholic. Think of all those towns in the South where there's more Baptists than there are people. That's what I'm talking about. And that's why I put this map out here. If you've never seen it, it's pretty startling. I used to keep it on my wall because people in New York didn't see this part of America. But it's from the Historical Atlas of American Religion, and which is a wonderful book in itself. But where more than where they have Catholic, Baptist, Latter-day Saints, Lutheran, etc., where one of those groups predominates, 50% or more, the county is colored a deep red or whatever the color is. And where it's only 25 to 50%, it's slightly lighter. You can see the Mormon Zion on there and the rest of it. And where the Methodist circuit riders came riding through to Kansas and Missouri and so on, done in yellow. Now, if you had to do this map today, as we talked about, it seems to me it would resemble, you know, a mound of ice cream in the summertime. Still strong in the middle and along the southern base, but melting on the east and west edges. So they would have to have lots of white space for the nones. But I can't, I'm going to read you a little something about, in a moment here, about embedded religion, particularly as I experienced it in the 50s. If you were a child, if you were a Catholic child growing up in the 50s, you felt yourself at the center of concentric circles of belonging. There were the people you saw at church on Sunday, were the kids at the parochial school. There were the Catholics at the other churches you went to on the weekend if you were traveling. There were all the Catholics on the earth, all the Catholics that ever existed, plus those saints who were looking down on us like grandparents from high front porches. So it was a deeply connected world because of the Catholic imagination. The Catholics, as I write about it here, were the largest parallel structure at that time in the United States. And my experience of it was that we were separated by a membrane, not a wall. Now, Orthodox Jews, Mormons at the time, were separated by a wall more than a membrane. But the membrane allowed a lot of things to come in, and it kept a lot of things out. And I think that pretty well describes the slow process of assimilation that took place and was completed by the time of Vatican Council II. But Catholics and everybody else belong to neighborhoods. To me, a neighborhood is a place where the people down the street, over on the next block, know your name, can call your parents or threaten to if they see you doing something you shouldn't be doing. You knew people down there because you cut their lawns, you delivered their newspapers, you saw them if you worked at the gas station or at the store. Kids were everywhere. As I said, in my community, which is a suburb about 50 miles west of downtown Cleveland, we owned the place more than the place owned us. Think of John Updike's hometown that he wrote about all the time. He's a product of the same period, and that was the feeling. That means we were in touch with lots of adults. We saw them and they saw us. Today, you find whole swaths of America that have no real neighborhoods. Well, why? Because nobody's living in them. They're both out working. You got to have somebody in those houses in order to have a neighborhood. It's a very attenuated situation. Then there was a sense of safety, too. I ran away from home twice before I was 8 years old. Not because it was a problem at home, but because my buddy and I, we got our toys and we got some sandwiches and we wanted to see the rest of the town. We went down the railroad tracks and we were perfectly confident everything was going to be fine. You wouldn't let your kids do that today. You wouldn't let your grandchildren do that today, but we could do it. And it happened not only in the suburb that I was at, but it happened in the cities in New York. Kids took the train and the subway and went up to the ballpark and saw the Yankees play and came back again. Parents thought nothing of it. Obviously, at this time, culture supported the practice of religion. One telltale sign, when Eisenhower ran for president the second time around, the Republican National Committee met, and they declared that Ike was not only the President of the United States, not only the Commander-in-Chief, but he was the spiritual leader of our country. Now, imagine if they had said something like that about Bush Jr., say, or something. It was that kind of time. There's one other dimension of connection that I want to talk about here, and pardon me, but I'm going to read. It's called Growing Up on the Home Front. And a paragraph? Okay. Am I getting long in the tooth?
Almost.
I got a lot more to go. Well, I'll skip it. What it was, is it talks about rationing that we did and what we couldn't have. It talked about, being part of the war effort. It talked about raising, limp beanstalks and lettuce the size of baseballs in a victory garden, because 40% of all the vegetables consumed in the 40s were grown on victory garden plants just like ours in the backyard. And at home, my father was an air raid warden, so once a month he put on a yellow cap and made sure that everybody turned off their lights lest the enemy airplanes invade from, the southern shores of Canada. So we knew a war was going on. My brother and I kept a scrapbook of headlines and from the war front. And we got patches that the men wore, the colorful, out of cereal boxes, and we made airplanes out of balsam and, wood and glue, the planes that they flew. So we knew there was a war going on. I don't think that's true today, and hasn't been for a while. Experiential religion is one I can talk about very briefly, which is what came out of the counterculture. The whole attraction of the East, to the Maharishi the whole turn to any kind of religion except your parents' religion. That was verboten. The phrase comes from William James, but I use it narrowly to refer to this, as I've just described. It was any belief or practice as long as it wasn't the one you were supposed to inherit. And the idea was to experience your inner self as sacred, and if luckily, a sacred cosmos. How did this come about? Well, it couldn't have come about except through the change in immigration laws in 1965, which allowed Asian and Indians and the rest of these to come over. And, of course, with what happened in Tibet, a lot of Buddhist tukuls came over. So if they weren't here, they wouldn't have been accessible. The other part of it was the drug culture. No question about it. Because the thought was through meditation you could reach certain levels of consciousness without using the drugs. Timothy Leary, who I saw a lot of in those days, did both. At one party he drank water from the Ganges and with his LSD. And he swore everybody got transformed into Hindu gods and goddesses. Of course, he was Shiva with the erect phallus, and he had his, consorts that he accommodated him. That was one kind of religion, and it was very serious among the students, and it was taken into the suburbs. Movement religion is rather more important. With the emergence of the civil rights movement in the mid-50s, we witnessed a new way that Americans got religion, rather than embedded religion. It doesn't matter where you come from in movement religion. It didn't matter what your ethnic background was. It didn't matter who your parents were or whether you're religious or not. All that mattered, really, was the movement. And I do want to read something here because I want to give you the flavor of a very short paragraph. So by this movement religion, I mean the forms that religious activism took once civil rights movement became the new and accepted model for expressing and mobilizing religious conscience and commitment. I also mean the correlative impulse of secular movements to assume the trappings of a religious crusade or quest. In either form, and often in combination, movement religion was directed as much against religious institutions as it was against secular establishments. To become part of a movement was to adopt a new group identity, we in the movement, that often assumed precedence over all other previous identities. Regardless of the cause, movement people all spoke the same idiom. To be in the movement was to support the struggle, to fight for liberation, to resist oppression, to bear witness, to speak truth to power, in a word, to be prophetic. The evil that movements hurled against, movements hurled themselves against were never merely personal. It was always what? Systemic. The military, the government, the university, the church, the bourgeois family, these and other institutions oppressed because by their very structures, because they were corrupt. Movements, on the other hand, created brotherhoods and sisterhoods, pure bonds of human solidarity. Whatever the cause, history and righteousness were aligned with the movement. Okay, that's and I carry that out, whether in liberation theology, the women's movement, and different forms like that. Here is entrepreneurial religion, which is my language for evangelical religion. Why do I call it that? First, because it is very entrepreneurial in creating new ministries and movements in response to changing social cultural landscape. If there's a man's movement going on or a woman's movement, they'll have a Christian woman's movement or an evangelical men's movement. And we saw a number of these. Secondly, because traditionally graduates of evangelical seminaries are expected to plant new churches, not go to work for one that's already there. Am I right, Michael? Pretty much, yeah. And the third thing is that historically, free enterprise capitalism and evangelicalism grew up together in Great Britain. In short, evangelicalism is free enterprise in religion. And I guess I don't have time to go into this, but there would be no religious right without the without evangelical radio and then evangelical television. And the FCC helped in this because they wouldn't in the 50s give free local airtime except to the evangelicals and the fundamentalists, only the Protestants, mainline Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. So the fundamentalists and evangelicals went out and bought time. And then when there wasn't any free time left over, they already had the stations. And that was key, it seems to me, to the political expression of this later on. Of course, the entrepreneur of them all was Billy Graham. He was chairman of the board. He was friend of presidents. And like that other chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra, Billy Graham was a brilliant stage performer. And the story I like to tell is this. When I went out and did a cover story on Billy in 1972, I think it was, the Honor America Day on 4th of July was coming up, and it was engineered by Colson and the rest in the White House, and Billy was to preside along with Fulton Sheen and a bunch of others. So I went out to visit him, and when I met up with him in Los Angeles, he was there with his team, and his team was all dressed in green sport coats. They all wore the same sport coat, and, you know, the coaches for Alabama, they all wear the same color and things like that. That was his team. And he was with them on the road more than half the year. Poor wife. Also, the car he had was green. The top of it was one of the Chrysler it's kind of a leather top. And he says, Ken, you know, this comes from a friend of mine who every time I come to Los Angeles, this is my car free to use. And then we got out of the car to go up to the radio studio to do the interview. He pulls out his wallet, and he shows me, he wants me to see this. Shows me a credit card from Willard Marriott, from Marriott Hotels. And he says, Ken, you know, with this card, he says, I can get into any Marriott hotel or motel for free. Now, I come from a family of salesmen, and I know that salesmen love their perks. Here's a man that had all kinds of prestige, and yet they valued a credit card to get in free at a Marriott hotel. So I said, Bill, you been to church today? And he says, no. He said, I don't go to church when I'm on the road. Well, you can imagine if you're Pastor Jones and then watch Billy Graham and sits down in the front pew, you get a little bit nervous. But he didn't go. So anyhow, I let that lie for a while. And so he was watching himself. He was editing a crusade that he had given, a famous one in Neyland Stadium, but I won't go into it, that Nixon appeared at. But in any case, he was editing it, and I said, Billy, what do you think about, what do you see when you see yourself on television preaching? And he says, I don't think of that myself at all. I think of just that person is there, God speaking through that person. And the Spirit of God is speaking through that person. And so it occurred to me that just by watching himself, Billy Graham had been to church after all.
Ken, I fear you're going to go through every chapter, and I do want to get into our response and our dialogue.
Oh, okay. So. Well, I want to get into politics just a little bit.
Just a little, and then I'm going to cut you off.
Oh, my God.
Go ahead.
You're like my mother.
I just see how many stacks you got left.
No. Okay.
Everybody's eager to get in.
Yeah, okay. Religious right. Who created the religious right? E.J. talked about 1964. That was certainly true. Civil rights. Or the Supreme Court decision banning prayers. That was certainly instrumental. Or the propensity for free enterprise, which I just discussed. I would point to three men. Paul Weyrich, Committee for the Survival of Free Congress. Richard Viguerie, Direct Mail Whiz. And Howard Phillips, Conservative Caucus. Because these three people thought up something called the moral majority. They thought it up because they saw what happened with Carter winning all the evangelicals, basically Southern Baptists in the South. And they went out and picked a guy named Jerry Falwell. So two Catholics and a Jew actually created moral majority. And I think that was... And the point I want to make with this is that up until that time, the evangelicals and fundamentalists did not identify with any particular party. They voted, although some didn't, but they didn't really get involved all that much. And so the politicalization of the evangelicals was done from the, in my view, from the party side rather than the other way around. Now, the last thing that I wanted to mention is religion as politics and the Democrats. We think of, for all the obvious reasons, of the GOP being religious, but, and Bush Sr. got up and said there is no GOD in their platform. Yet it seems to me the Democrats had the most religiously observant president we ever had in Jimmy Carter. And, you know, Bill Clinton never saw a pew that he couldn't sit in. I did an interview in 1994 because I couldn't get the president. They gave me Hillary, and we talked about her being a Methodist, and she's a very devout Methodist. But her youth minister, who was very important to her, said in an interview, "We Methodists know what's good for you." I mean, he was thinking that, you know, the Methodists gave us prohibition and things like this. And he was a bit tongue-in-cheek. And I said, yes, but that's the Democratic Party. But yes. And I think it's a party that wants to discipline the country. So it seems to me that with McGovern, who, after all, was raised in a Methodist manse, went to a Methodist college, studied for the Methodist ministry, decided to become a teacher, went back to his Methodist alma mater and taught there before he was asked to build up the party in South Dakota. And you could tell it when he was speaking. New York Catholics and Jews felt uncomfortable listening to this prairie preacher. But it was a politics of righteousness, and it, as Mark has pointed out in his book, it came about with the transformation of the Democratic Party away from the New Deal coalition to a new coalition of what? What do you use? The phrase, a coalition of conscience. And since we don't have time, I won't go into that, but I did take the trouble to go back in 1972, the year that the commission had changed the way the party handled its conventions, and who could be there. And of course it was the people who were outside the 1968 convention that were inside the 1972 convention. I looked at the Methodist Book of Resolutions for 1972. They meet every 4 years before the conventions do. And I found in there an amazing number of similar ideas, almost phrased the same way as what I found in the Democratic Party platform that same year. Now, I'm not suggesting that they purloined it or they stole the language. I'm suggesting if you look at the Democratic Party and what I call its politics of righteousness, which obviously emerged in Hillary's campaign, I think you learn a lot and learn something about the way that a religious tradition can inform a political party. So that is all I am going to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken. About 5 minutes before we end our session, we're going to hand out copies of Ken's book. We just didn't want you leafing through it during the session. And during the Q&A, Ken, I want to be sure we get into a question. I read Ken's book. One of the most insightful pieces of the book, which you left out, Ken, was the constant resistance you ran into from editors higher up. The best-selling issues of Newsweek were always the cover stories at Easter and Christmas written by Ken Wilber. But it seemed like even that didn't convince them that religion was a really important story. So I want you to explain some of those dialogues you had with some of your editors to convince them that what you're doing is actually so important. Grant Wacker is an American religious historian. He's written a very important book 2 years ago called America's Pastor, Billy Graham and the Shaping of a Nation, which was published by Harvard University Press. We like to promote books here. It's the definitive biography of Billy Graham. We ask Professor Wacker to respond to Ken because the area that Ken deals with in the book, which is the last 40 or 50 years, is one of Grant's specialties. So I thought he would be ideally suited to look at Ken's book and tell us what he thinks. Thank you, Professor Wacker, for joining us. Turn the button on.
That's the answer always. Turn the button on. Okay. I want to begin by thanking Michael for the extraordinary job he has done in putting these together. We heard his thanks this morning, and I want to reiterate it. As Michael said, I came to this Faith Angle Forum 19 years ago, and then again a few years ago, and each of them has just been invigorating, and you go home with a lot of friends and meet people that you have always been reading and hearing about. So thank you, Michael, for doing it. And I'll say a word about Ken. My first job was at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and that was back in 1977. And for some reason I can't remember, we had a journalist program. Rockefeller Foundation funded journalists to come in for a semester, and Ken came down. And we met at that time, and I'd say the highlight of the semester for me was a debate between Ken and Pat Robertson. You can't really imagine, as we say in the South, you can't hardly imagine two different people, two people who are more different, people are still talking about this debate after all these years, Ken.
Is it on YouTube?
It should be. I doubt if YouTube was invented back then, but He can tell you some.
He didn't talk to me after that at Christmas. Yeah. The way he talked on his program was enough.
Yeah. And I should say Pat Robertson never came back to UNC again either. So what I'm going to do now is in two parts, and the first part will be a little longer, and I will respond to the book. This is what Michael had asked me to do, and so it is a some of the things that I will say are not ones that have been said in the last hour because they refer to content of the book, and I highly recommend it. I retired last June. I'm not teaching. If I were teaching, I would most definitely assign the book for a Religion in America class. Sometime during the first Iraq War, I remember seeing a photo with a caption on the front page of my hometown newspaper. The photo showed an American sailor in the galley of a naval vessel sitting at a table with a food tray in front of him. His elbows were resting on the table. His hands were clasped under his chin. His head was bowed. His eyes were closed. The caption under the photo read, "Weary sailor rests head on hands before eating." Huh. Now, this is Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's a university town, and that may explain some of it. But what I thought about then is the tremendous disconnect between journalism, not you all, but much of journalism, and religion. And Ken has spent nearly four decades trying to repair that disconnect. As he mentioned, and I'll summarize again, as the religion editor of Newsweek, he wrote more than 1,000 articles, essays, and book reviews, including 70 covers, and I'm going to talk about the covers a little later. His senior editors were supportive, but often baffled by the religious culture and leaders he tracked down west of the Hudson and then described with determined sympathy. And I think that's an important point, is the geographic isolation or parochialization of, in this case, Ken's case, the Newsweek editors, and we can turn it around and say Middle America as well. For most of the post-war period, Newsweek, Time, and I would add U.S. News and World Report, were the news magazines of record. Each week, they told millions of Americans what the most important events were, and more important, what they meant. Now, I want to emphasize that point. When I was a kid, an adolescent, we would get Time and Newsweek, and it would sit on the coffee table in the living room, and you'd open it up, and there's the religion column. And by definition, that's what's important. And I think we need to think more about the enormous power that these magazines exercised in first choosing what was important and then interpreting them. So I go on to say, each week they told millions of Americans not only what the events were, but what they meant. Woodward's stories shaped readers' perception of what was going on in the religious world, especially in traditions not their own. I grew up in a very parochial religious tradition. I knew nothing about Catholics except what I read in Ken's columns. In a nutshell, this book, Getting Religion, is a social history of the second half of the 20th century. It puts religion at the center of the story. Ken uses personal memoir as well as portraits of key figures to make the history come alive. He rightly suggests that being there on the scene, personally interacting with the protagonists, offered an immediacy and thus a distinct perspective that more distant academic studies often missed. And I hope later, Ken, you'll talk more about the role of the leaders and your interaction with them, because it's a whole dimension of the story of religion in America that I would say most academics simply have no access to. Ken's main argument is that the conditions in which people get religion strongly influence the kinds of religion they get. Faith cannot be reduced to those trends, but it cannot be divorced from them either. For example, one chapter that Ken has talked about the decline of the family, he contrasts with the sudden appearance of more than 300 new religious cults, as he calls them, most of which take the form of sacred families. These emerged in the late 1970s, a time when a million kids, mostly from white middle-class families, ran away from home. So we see a kind of compensatory effect. They're running away, but also they're compensating by replicating the structures that they ran away from. I found the chapter on entrepreneurial religion extremely perceptive, the stuff I've worked on, and I found many of Ken's ideas very useful. Not all of them, but many of them. And he shows how evangelicalism rose with its embrace of free enterprise capitalism, or to put another way, how evangelical religion was free enterprise religion. By Ken's telling, the extraordinary pace and intensity of social change running from Eisenhower to Obama released two forms of religion, embedded and movement. These are key terms, embedded religion and movement religion. These two forms, broadly conceived, might be conceived as a double helix, as Ken has told us. Let me say a little bit more about embedded religion. Embedded religion was tied to churches and synagogues, schools, regions, ethnic and racial groups, and families, nuclear and extended. One of the most intriguing parts of the book is how Ken uses his own Catholic boyhood in Ohio as a case study of how embedded religion emerged from its social setting, what it looked like, and how it worked to shape believers' lives. Oh, he tells us his father came to Christ in a Billy Sunday revival. His mother and her extended family were devoutly Catholic, and that is how he was reared. Catholic schools, Catholic friends, priests, and nuns formed his world. A cultural ecosphere capped off with 4 years at Notre Dame, where he met his wife, Betty, who was a student at neighboring St. Mary's College. This embedded religion was a cultural universe. It was separated from mainstream Protestant culture by a membrane. It's not a solid membrane, it's a porous membrane, but nonetheless, it's a membrane and it forms a cultural universe. Now, I want to turn to the second strand of the helix, and that is what he calls the extraordinary and unexpected sunburst of religious enthusiasm that paralleled the first strand. It's not unique in American history. In the 19th century, we see this. I think we see it in the 1730s as well. But what we see in post-World War II is, truly by any measure, this extraordinary efflorescence of religion. Now, what's movement religion? It's powered by a coalition of co-believers, or sometimes co-belligerents, in a common cause. Its members happen to be from Detroit, or happen to be Methodist, or happen to be Irish, but their main bond lay in the pursuit of a shared goal. They were, in effect, religious special interest groups, animated with religious fervor, spiritual commitment, collegial intimacy, and often enough, a legitimating sense of ultimacy. So this contrast between embedded religion and movement religion is key to the book, and I think it makes a major contribution to our study of religion in America. In a succession of fast-paced chapters, he sketches in roughly chronological order the parade of movements that mark the age. One by one, they advance civil rights, anti-war protest, women's rights, liberation theology, evangelical entrepreneurialism, new forms of sacred families, counterculture and Asian religions, therapeutic religion, Republicans and the religious right, and Democrats and politicized religion, especially among Methodists. Ken's stories reveal worlds within worlds, and this is intriguing. I think that as you read it, and as I would urge other people to do it, one of the most important parts is the stories themselves that give life, give flesh to these larger structures. For example, Ken's evocation of the drama and pathos of the historic civil rights trek from Selma to Montgomery in 1965 is one of the beautiful and utterly memorable features of the book. Like a television photojournalist, he takes us back to that day when the Reverend Martin Luther King strode with Rabbi Abraham Heschel at the head of the march. And Ken quotes Heschel, who said, "That day, I prayed with my legs." Ken does not argue that movement religion won and embedded religion lost. But by my reading of the evidence he details, it does look like embedded religion came up short. In the 1950s, for example, 98% of Americans said they believed in God. Baptists and Catholics alone accounted for 40% of the population. A half century later, 25% of Americans claim no religious identification. It's not quite the figure we heard this morning, but pretty close. And another 50% acknowledged only moderate or intermittent concern for religion. The foundations of the powerful culture-religion symbiosis of the 1950s had fragmented, and they had reconfigured in new and unpredictable ways. Woodward can say more in a single sentence than many historians can say in an entire article or book. For me, I'm as Protestant as Ken is Catholic, and the line that sticks best is the one that stung most. And the line is, "If the Protestant Reformation was built on a trinity of alones, Christ alone, faith alone, the Bible alone, revivalism added a fourth. The voice alone, addressed to the listener as an isolated me alone." Now, to be sure, even the most flamboyant of the revivalists, when you think of Billy Sunday or Amy McPherson, they knew perfectly well that Christ, faith, and the Bible, not me alone, it was Christ, faith, and the Bible, was the foundation of evangelical Christianity. But I would say that Ken is basically right. Most of the time, that's not the way they behaved, and that's not how they acted. And I would add that one of the special parts of the book is how witty it is. Growing up Catholic, he remembers, we imagined the public school girls were looser than the academy girls, while my pals in the public schools were convinced that Catholic academy girls were lustier because they were more repressed. We all talked more than we knew. And then he goes on in another place to say, as a graduate student in English at the University of Iowa, he soon found that graduate school was a place to study literature, not enjoy it. And some of my favorite lines are the character sketches of individuals. They tells us the handsome and expansive Hans Kuhn loved the microphone. Bill Bright was a short, somber, rather unctuous undertaker kind of man. Paul Tillich inspired his former student, James Pike, to live on the boundary of Christian faith, including the boundary of Christian marriage. Both were notorious philanderers, and neither went to church unless he was the preacher. Other individuals come out looking pretty good. One of my favorite lines, the mature Billy Graham had the gift of making the simplest sentence sound like sacred scripture. And best of all, Woodward knows how to poke fun at himself. When an aging Reinhold Niebuhr agreed to sit down with me, he says, and agreed to talk, I asked him every question I could think of. Afterward, Niebuhr advised through intermediaries that if I listened more and talked less, I'd get better interviews. Now, Ken is not above exaggerating a point in order to make a point. Billy Graham's evangelism, he argues with a straight face, leaped over millennia of Christian history to promote an individualized biblical Christianity that was, in effect, born yesterday. Well, I would say that claim is true as far as it goes, but there's more. I'll focus on Graham. The letters, the millions of letters that the faithful posted to Graham over the years, suggest that they were writing to Graham not to plumb his knowledge of the Bible, and certainly not his knowledge of history, but rather they wrote because they saw him as a pastor who might help them deal with their private pain and find a path to a second chance. It's a rare book that brings so many virtues to the table, including the potential for stirring, frank discussion about our culture and where we are headed. And I would conclude by saying that Getting Religion is a major achievement, and it's a fitting capstone for a long and distinguished career. Ken.
Thank you, Brent. Thank
those
you.
Those are my I'll buy comments. You a drink.
Yeah, comments about the book, and I have just a few comments I would make about Ken's remarks today. And I hope that, and I will focus on evangelicals in particular, because they were the subject of this morning's invigorating conversation. First, the import of covers. Billy Graham appeared on 34 covers, U.S. News, Newsweek, and Time. And I think this is extraordinarily important. How often do we see the cover stories about mainline religious leaders? I believe the last one was Franklin Clark Fry in about 1960. And the power of the magazines and then the cover on these magazines to reify what's important is a subject that we haven't studied nearly enough. And I'd go beyond that to say is that they legitimate the study of a subject, and even more, the columns, or as we say in the South, the columns that they have about religion. So the covers are not inconsequential. And particularly, as I go back to Graham, they almost always show these strikingly handsome images of a white Graham with perfect teeth, perfect smile, and how do they reify certain images? All right? Ken raised the point of how journalists learn more by being outside a tradition than within it, in some cases, in some ways. And I think this is consistently true, and I would say that in my study of Graham, the best journalists, or among the best journalists, have in fact been Jews. I think especially of Ken Garfield, the Charlotte Observer, and then Kathy Grossman, and there are others. And my sense there is that they don't have a dog in the fight, and so they can afford to be empathetic and critical in a way. So that's another question that's worth thinking about, is the role of a kind of critical engagement rather than distance. Third issue that Ken raises, it's worth thinking about and talking about, is that he said, evangelicals are not embedded. They're part of a movement religion, and I emphatically agree with that. Evangelicals as a group have no ecclesiology. They don't have much sense of sacraments either. But there's more to it than that. Is what evangelicalism is about, in many ways, is conversion. And what is conversion? It's leaving who you were and becoming something else. So the notion of becoming something else is absolutely fundamental to the tradition. And I would add to it the issue of itinerancy. That's a big difference. Okay. Itinerancy is important to the tradition, and you get the notion of conversion, the notion, the centrality of itinerancy, and what that suggests about mobility, and we get a sense of the malleability and the amorphousness and the whole movement of the tradition. And that may have ramifications for our understanding of evangelicals and politics. Just one more. Ken talks about the Catholic imagination. I've never in my life thought of using the word imagination with reference to evangelicals. We have good evangelical historians, good philosophers, journalists, but we don't have evangelical dancers. And
you haven't been to my church.
Well, okay. Liturgical dancers and artists, and particularly in visual arts. And I think this is a key issue because it says something about epistemology, how evangelicals think. Who else thinks like that? Mormons. If you go to various evangelical denominational headquarters, you'll see art usually on the wall, and you would not know that you're not in Salt Lake City. There is a certain kind of realist epistemology lacking imagination. And I have never heard or read anyone who traces that to political activity, but that's a topic just waiting. I said that would be my last comment, but it's not. I lied. I'm going to make one more. And that is suggested by a variety of things that Ken says, but not explicitly, and that is evangelicals have a great sense of prophetic sense, calling the nation to be something more than it has been, but on the whole, they have no sense of irony. They have little sense of, well, they have little sense of institutional humor and next to no sense of lament about themselves. And so there's a great deal of judgment about how the nation has gone astray, usually astray from its blueprint, but not nearly as much of looking inside, where have we gone astray? Well, those are my comments, Ken, about your book, and then a few other thoughts that you triggered in my mind about the movement.
Thank you. Thank you, Grant. Okay, Tom Jelton, you're up first. Grab the mic. And then EJ and Sally. All three right over here.
If you're covering politics, the obligation is to be as nonpartisan as possible, and some editors like Len Downey, you know, even advocate not voting. And I'm wondering what the corollary is for covering religion. You did say one interesting thing, which is that the more immersed you are in one tradition, the better able you are to understand another tradition. But I wonder if you could elaborate on that. Is being a devout believer an advantage or a disadvantage, when it comes to, if you believe in sort of one true faith, how does that position you with respect to other faiths, for example?
Well, first of all, there is a certain sense that if you don't believe your faith is the one true faith, then why are you there? You know, there's always that attitude. But once you understand yourself, when I mean deep immersion, I mean a couple of things. It means, for me as a Catholic, when I go out to, some place, one of the Orthodox places out in Brooklyn, I feel at home. There's all kinds of, physical or material things there. There's laws of observation, practices and so forth that remind me analogically to Catholic practices, especially when I was a kid when you still had boundaried religion. Namely, we were people who didn't eat, meat on Friday, and there were other sins that only we could commit. And when you have a tradition where only you can commit the sins, you really do have a strong tradition. So I used Heschel's example of the he had such sympathy, such concern about these statues, and where statues don't figure in his world at all. Those are the examples that I want to give. But you don't walk out and say, "Gee, I don't think your religion's right." That's not it. The job for me was, I learned, I had anybody I talked to about, including Catholics, even though there's a lot of them, for my audience, they were all other people. I had to tell them what it was like, what it felt, when I could, what it felt like to be a Mormon and why they took this particular angle and so forth. So that's what I'm talking about. But I was also talking about personally, if you get into interfaith dialogues and things like that, a lot of the Jewish Catholic dialogues didn't work because they all wanted to talk about Israel. I mean, that's all the Jewish participants did. And they couldn't get around where Heschel and I never talked about the war. We talked about God. And we talked about, you know, his, if you read his stuff, the kind of things that he does. And that's what I, you know, really had in mind. And usually people who stay away from it, I grant what Grant said about being outside and not having a horse in the race. But you got to really like religion a lot. You can have a horse in the race and still, you know, be fair to all the participants. You know, more than that, I can't. I just know that if Seth is a vague and vaporous, you can't identify with it very well.
Did you have a follow-up?
No.
You look like, okay, EJ, you're up next.
By the way, Mike, I want to congratulate you. As of a little while ago, Faith Angle Forum was the number two trending item on Twitter, two places ahead of the Golden Globes and four places ahead of Trump. So there you go.
Well, if I would say something offensive about Trump, maybe he would then retweet it.
Yeah, right.
Tell me what a scoundrel I am, and that would really take off.
I thank you to Ken and to Grant. I want to ask a question about a relatively narrow slice of history at the beginning of your career, Ken, to invite both you and Grant to make a larger point, that you started at Newsweek, if I remember right, in 1964. And in 1965, my old teacher, Harvey Cox, published The Secular City, which celebrated the loosening of the world from religious and quasi-religious understandings of itself. Mm-hmm. This was a sort of a religious bestseller. It took hold in the world. And Harvey's an honest guy, and he's revisited himself over the years. In this same period, as you remember better than anybody, Time magazine, in a very short period, had Is God Dead on a cover in 1965, and if I remember the year right, Is God Coming Back to Life in 1969. So they killed God off in 65, brought him back in 69. What I wanted to ask about is a kind of two-part question. One is just to reflect on, for both of you really, to reflect on that time when these ideas were floating around, why they took hold, why they were so popular among religious people, particularly Harvey had a great Catholic readership, as you remember, and how they hold up. And, you know, in some ways you can easily say, well, the rise of Islam, the rise of religious right, these ideas were all wrong. And yet, if you look at the rising numbers of non-participants, some of Grant's figures about the decline of embedded religion, it's not so clear that the thesis, I reread the book recently, and in some ways the thesis seemed fresh again. I'm just curious how, if you could talk about both that time and what it says about our time.
And during that time, C.S. Lewis was on the cover of one of those magazines.
I'm sorry?
C.S. Lewis was on the cover of one of those magazines during that time.
Yeah, so was Bishop Pike for different reasons.
Which you have a chapter on Bishop Pike, if I have a warmly recommend.
No, Bishop Pike is I use him to describe certain forms of decline in the mainline Protestantism. He was a pathetic case at the end. I was the last journalist he talked to, by the way, before he went off to Israel and died. Look. That wasn't ours. I wish it was.
That's great.
We did have one with Harvey Cox's class. There were feminists who were complaining every time he used God, he, you know.
You brought it up something funny. I was looking for some Harvey stuff, and I found my 1971 Harvard Crimson story on that class, which I took, where every time there was a male reference to God or anything else, people blew kazoos for two
right,
weeks.
They
it was
did.
A very interesting moment religious history.
that class is in this book. I mean, Harvey was always on, he was on to the next hot thing, but he missed the woman thing altogether. And, of course, the anthropology class patronizingly said, don't worry about it, it's only pronoun envy. And that was the title of our piece in Newsweek, Pronoun Envy. And well, it was one of the great inspired headlines. Harvey's book was quite extraordinary in many ways. It was a huge international bestseller. He had just come back from Germany. He was studying German sociology there, and he really applied it in this book. The take that I have, therefore one of my takes would be on it, that first of all, he quickly found that the reenchantment of the world in his next book very quickly. He was always agile and likable in that for that reason. You know, what he was talking about, I want to make two comments on this, and they come from the book. But one is the first thing he was talking about was the best and the brightest, the Kennedy, can do technology. You know, it could be Friedman today. This is going to take can do optimism. That was one thing. He was, but he wasn't talking, he was the east side of New York, of Manhattan, not the lower west side. Or the side. He ignored the still enchanted Catholics. He didn't talk about the people that were in going to storefront churches. I mean, and also it had, in my judgment, went all the way back to John Winthrop's City on a Hill, we're the chosen people to come to this continent, et cetera. The white Anglo-Saxon Protestant was still going to be in charge. But he was hidden back in a way, like the Jesuits were in Sweden when they were trying to reconvert them. If you read it, they're still going to be there. It's secular, but the seculars are going to need guidance. And even though it seems like the Protestant establishment was no longer an establishment, if you read that, look at that book again, they're still the one with right-thinking liberal Catholics. They were really going to be the guiding the secular city. So he left room for that, and so those are the two points that I have to make. One, that he was really talking about an elite, and it was very optimistic. And the other thing, there was a third thing, which was the effect of Martin Luther King and those marches and all of that gave a real spirit of optimism at a time when we lost a president, we lost his brother. These all came in the same years. And his is a brightly optimistic way of looking at things. I suppose the secular city looked a lot like like the Great Society in terms of its practical politics.
Two very quick agenda.
We didn't mention death of God theology. Ken writes about it a good deal. It had a very short shelf life.
What did the death of God?
Death of God theology made a splash and it was gone. But I think there was a much longer ramification of death of God theology, or perhaps that's an artifact of a deeper trend, and that's the mainline's willing relinquishment of cultural authority. The mainline voluntarily emptying itself of its authority and saying we have to welcome all kinds of pluralisms. And in the process, we're going to acknowledge that we do not and should not have a custodial role. And that is a huge shift in the history of the mainline, because through the 1960s, it exercised this custodial role. And I think, Ken, you write about how many of the mainliners voted Republican until about the 60s, and then they began to become much more diverse. So that's one long-range effect of secularization of the city. The other is something that we haven't talked about today, and that's the role of anti-Catholicism. And how intense that was, and it worked both ways, but if we think particularly about evangelicals, until quite recently, until the 1970s, it would be difficult to exaggerate the intensity of evangelicals' dislike and fear of Catholics and the possibility of a Catholic conspiracy. It sounds utterly preposterous now. When I tell undergraduates about it, they have no idea. They can't even imagine such a thing. But the fear of a conspiracy by Catholics in linking arms with communists, right, to take over America. Well, this leads to a larger point, and that is the necessity of an adversary. And it strikes me that evangelicals always need an adversary, partly for self-definition, but also for self-invigoration.
Is Islam the new Catholicism?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we have communism. Well, I mean, we have the Roman Catholic Church, and then we have communism, and anti-Catholicism continues. But then it's understandable why Catholics and evangelicals would now be linking hands. They've got a common enemy.
I wanted to mention something, which is the phrase that we heard at that same time you're talking about. If you remember, it was God is setting the agenda, yep. And our job is to see what God is up to. Well, leadership sets the agenda, to back up what he was saying, and they were linking the leadership was that notion. Hillary Clinton got sent down to the inner city to see how the other half lived, where God was setting the agenda. So I think that was terribly important. And the other thing is secular theology, beginning with Cox and all the others that were in there. The only one that interested me was Altizer, by the way. He was practically unreadable. But he read William Blake, and I liked William Blake, and so that was it. Secular theology was addressed to people, not to secular people. They didn't give a damn about it. I mean, that's one of the problems when you do things like that, is the people you're praising aren't even going to read your book. So...
Yeah, that's a problem. Sally Quinn is up next. Yes, and then Bill Galston and Kathleen.
I just want to say one, to back up what you said. Novak, Bob Novak, who was the columnist, who was Jewish, and he married a woman who was an evangelical from Texas. And I don't know whether you know this story or not. And his mother wasn't too crazy that she married a Jew, but she accepted it. But then Bob converted to Catholicism, and she refused to ever speak to him again.
There's a hierarchy of enemies, yes. Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham. I've met Billy Graham a number of times when, you know, in the early days when he was at his peak. And Franklin, as I'm sure you know, has exploited his father and his father's reputation, his father's image terribly. And I mean, Billy Graham is, I went to Billy Graham's 90th birthday party, and Franklin put on the whole thing. And, you know, the guest of honor was Sarah Palin, and, you know, it was that crowd. I mean, nobody who was friends of Billy Graham was there. And he was running ads, anti-homosexual ads, in the North Carolina paper. I'm sure you saw them, with Billy Graham's name. I just wonder what role Franklin... I interviewed Franklin at one point, and he... I always ask these questions in my video interviews, if you've ever had any doubts about your faith. And of all the hundreds and hundreds of people I have ever interviewed, everyone has said that there have been moments of doubt, except for Franklin Graham, who said he had never had a single doubt in his life. And I just, you know, I mean, he's been anti-Muslim. I just want to know, from your experience, what is the attitude about Franklin Graham? Are the evangelicals buying his act?
No, thank you, Sally. You wrote some wonderful things about this question. I say wonderful because we agreed. I think it's a complicated question, actually, and Peter Boyer and I were talking about this last night. Franklin's a complicated figure. In some ways, there are two Franklins. There is the Samaritan's Purse CEO, yeah. And last year, Samaritan's Purse gave away $500 million in humanitarian relief, no questions asked. You know, whenever there's a natural catastrophe, I mean, Samaritan's Purse is right there on the ground. But then there's the other side of Franklin, who is a culture warrior. And I would love to see a doctoral student somehow get to him enough that they could write a dissertation about this very complicated man. Maybe the one side energizes the other. I don't know. But what I do think is that Franklin does not speak for his father. His father's now 98, and it's difficult to talk about this without incurring a charge of ageism. But, you know, for a decade, the senior Graham hasn't been able to relate to the world out there. And so when journalists, and I think you and I have talked about this on the phone, when journalists call me, I simply try to say that the views that Franklin represents are not the views that his father represented at the time that he was, shall we say, commenting about the world around him. Now, and I don't want to exaggerate that. I mean, there are some continuities, but the main difference is one of tone, a renaissance, and an attempt to bring as many people as possible within the hearing range of the gospel, rather than to draw lines and to cut people out. The final question, which troubles me, intrigues me, worries me as a historian, is has Franklin so created the image of the Graham family that it's impossible to get through that image back to the original Billy? I think it's possible. I'm hoping it, certainly. But increasingly, I find people who are willing to... But increasingly, they ask me, does Franklin speak for his father? And there's this tone there, like, surely not. And then just the, you know, just one quotation that I write about, and I think that you've written about in 2004, Laurie Goodstein asked Billy if he agreed with Franklin, and Franklin said that Islam is an evil religion. And Billy said, well, I love my son, but some things we differ about, and this is one. And so then she went on to ask, is the conflict between Western and Islamic civilization the great conflict that looms ahead of us? And Billy said, no. He said, I think the great conflict that looms is, in so many words, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, is between those of us with affluence and hunger and poverty around the world. That's very different in some ways from Franklin, yeah.
Billy changed enormously, and I take the change as when he went to the Soviet Union, I mean to Eastern Europe for the first time, and came across Christians there who seemed more committed than the ones he knew back home. And for the first time, the separation of Christianity from America became, I think, very real for him. And then during that trip, he went to Krakow, and he was to meet the local archbishop, who suddenly got called to Rome because they had to pick a new pope, and of course, you know, he never came back home. So when Billy saw him come out on the porch, and the first thing he said is something like, Christ, Christ is the answer. And Billy told me, he says, oh my God, he's an evangelist. And I thought, you know, of all the things that pope was, and he was a great man and multi-gift philosopher and so forth, he was an evangelist, and it took one to know one. And then when they wouldn't let the Pope into the Soviet Union, but they let Billy in, Billy said, well, first of all, he acknowledged the Pope as the spiritual religious leader of the West. That's a big change from where he came, from the fundamentalism he came from. And then he said, I got invited to the Soviet Union because they wouldn't let the Pope in. And I thought, this is a whole change thing. And of course, when the Pope died, the only organization other than the churches that got invited to the funeral was the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. And then he told me one time that he felt most at home in the evangelical wing. I think we mentioned that the other day, the evangelical wing of the Anglican Church. And I think he liked to dress up a little bit because Baptist threads, after all, are just simply Baptist threads.
I'd add one point quickly, and I got this from Ken, actually, and you forgot it, is that I think that when Graham went to Krakow in 1979, for the first time he saw the power of the church. He saw what the church could do in society in a very positive way. Yeah.
Okay, Bill Gosson is up next. Bill.
Well, Ken, you said something that sent my fingers flying. And here's what I found, and it's sort of astonished me. Since I became of voting age, the Democrats have nominated 4 Methodists for President of the United States.
Really?
Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, my old boss Fritz Mondale, and Hillary Clinton. Notice something about that list? And I guess, so here is my, and by the way, that's after a very long, the last Democratic president who was a Methodist turns out to be James K. Polk. And maybe there's a reason for that. So, here is my question, and I'm delighted to be able to pose it to people who may actually be able to answer it. What is there about Methodism that seems to be politically rebarbative, even if it's spiritually impressive?
Politically what?
Rebarbative, as in, hard to swallow. Right. What is there about the affect of a Methodist in public life that seems to create difficulties?
I was just saying, we Methodists know what's good for you. That's what the pastor said, and that's the attitude. We already know. You saw it in Hillary Clinton when her husband said, "You take care of health care." And she had a stack of Methodist papers like this to walk into with it, because they had been working on that issue for healthcare for a long time. There's just, that sense comes off. Not all Methodists, obviously. Look, the Methodists in the middle of the 19th, they come in the early part of the 19th century, they get transplanted here. Middle of the 19th century, according to Nathan Hatch, historian, they were the largest national organization, is that quite the right way? Or the widest network, perhaps, of institutions in the country, except for the federal government itself. They have an instinct, it goes right back to one half of Wesley, the founder, is to, first to reform yourself. And the Wesleyan wing of Methodism emphasizes that, right? That's where Pentecostal comes from. And the other side was what we somewhat erroneously call the social gospel. We're going to change society. And out of that comes the Salvation Army. That's just part of, who they are. But knowing what is good for you is very much a part of that attitude. That would be my answer to your question.
Grant Wacker?
That's a great question. And actually, I'm a Methodist, and at this moment, I'm sorry to say. I didn't know that there were 4 recent presidents that, or candidates for president, that were Methodists. I didn't put it together that way, so thank you. That's a tough question, and why have they been unsuccessful? And I would agree that Ken has a pretty good answer to it, but I also think that Methodism assimilates too well. In a sense, it lacks backbone. There's not an edge. And there's certain sects or sections of Methodism that certainly have an edge, but on the whole, it doesn't have that, and so it accommodates too easily, and so that there is not, this... compelling message of change. That's the best I can do.
Can you explain the theological reasons for that?
Just to say, Stanley Hauerwas, who's got the dirtiest mouth of any theologian I ever ran across. I'm sure you never had him here. You'd have to blank him out all the time. But Stanley is a Methodist, and he said, "We Methodists are nice. We are nice people. Problem is, the word nice isn't in the Bible." Talking about lacking edge.
Now, Peter, you and I were talking about this in some ways last night. Yeah.
George W. Bush is Methodist.
What's that?
George W. Bush is Methodist.
Bush?
That's right.
Converted, yeah.
Yeah.
No.
But
you're talking about Bush Jr.?
Yeah. I mean, we can debate the finer points of the evangelical influence on that. But
Bush Jr.
Just to complicate that.
Bush Jr. married the church, I mean, joined the church of his wife's choice. He's really raised in the small group movement that Robert Withnow wrote a book about. That's where he comes out of.
Yeah.
And his and he had been an Episcopalian, he had been a number of different things. But the formative influence is that. And that had something to do with his, effort to, however political it might be, to use churches to, it was his father's 1,000 points of light run through the churches. But it was, I think, because of his work in the small group. I talk about that in the book. He could have done more with that, but they really didn't. The White House didn't want to do much with it.
Elizabeth makes a good point. I mean, formally he is Methodist, but is he primarily Methodist or primarily evangelical? And see, this brings up the tension between movement religion and embedded religion, denominational religion and movement. And, you know, it's a mobile tension. Yeah, great. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a short 10-minute break till 3 o'clock, and then we'll come back, and then we're going to have a 3-hour free time for you to go to the beach and the pool. But right now, if we could take a 10-minute break, then we'll come back and get right back to it. Thank you.